Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. I am your co-host, Chris Seveny. Unfortunately, Lauren Wells could not join us today, but I do have a special guest. I have Michael Zaransky from MZ Capital Partners. Michael specializes in ground-up construction and has spent decades in multifamily housing. He is also an author, written many books, and also a part of many industry trade associations, including the National Apartment Association, National Multifamily Housing Council, ULI. So on today's episode, we will be talking about some pivots that Michael did from competitive bidding on existing multifamily into ground up construction, which many people know that's kind of where I cut my teeth. We'll talk about raising equity for real estate deals. And we'll also talk about, of course, you know, doing good while doing well. So the whole giving back to community and other features. So Michael, how are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thank you for having me, Chris. I look forward to speaking.
And before we started, you know, Michael and I are in climates that are not the warmest today. And I was telling them, some of my partners who were out in California were complaining how it was too hot and they were, you know, sweating and getting bitten by mosquitoes. And my joke was that, you know, our mosquitoes are frozen. We don't have to worry about getting bit by them today. So,
we should let them know, we both agreed that we don't feel sorry for them one bit.
Exactly. So let's roll right into things. And you know, let's talk a little bit about where you are today, and then we'll work backwards to how you got there. But, you know, what is your primary focus today at MZ Capital?
Today, our primary focus is ground up new construction development of apartment buildings, multifamily communities, focus on suburban garden style construction, lumber stick built products with surface parking lots, in high growth suburban areas where we believe there's a shortage of available housing and there's a imbalance between supply and demand based upon high levels of occupancy and rent growth that we track.
What are a few areas right now where you've got projects going on across the country?
We have a project in a suburb of Knoxville, Tennessee, in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is a very stable and rapidly growing area, as well as in Illinois, which is our home state, in Lake County, Illinois, a city called Mundelein, as well as Buffalo Grove, Illinois, in various stages of construction and planning.
For people who are newer to listening to our podcast, you know, ground up is where I cut my teeth for 25 plus years. I was more on the high-rise construction component versus the garden style. I've done some garden style projects, but by the end of this episode, I'll probably be chomping at the bit again to get back into construction. So I know Chi will be very happy and Delaney and Lauren will probably be running scared. One of the questions I had is prior to that, you were, you know, really just looking at acquisition of multifamily property, correct?
Yes, for many, many years, built a nice portfolio of both student housing assets, existing ones on seven major college campuses, as well as buying the type of product we're building, suburban garden style communities in Houston, Texas area and in Tennessee and throughout Illinois. And we made lots of acquisitions. We still own several in the portfolio, but we were a value add player and added value to the apartments by making cosmetic improvements, capturing the rent growth that resulted from that. In many cases, exited and sold those properties at a pretty substantial gain as a result.
So what caused you to make that shift? Because that is a, from a business decision, that's, I think, a major shift to go from an acquisition strategy to kind of acting, you know, ground up development, the developer type strategy. I'm guessing it probably didn't happen overnight, but what were some of the reasons and the thought process and some of the hurdles in getting, making that transition?
Well, first and foremost, over the cost, over the length of our company's career, we have done some development over time. Okay. Initially, as a joint venture partner with more experienced ground up developers, learned the business and got comfortable with it. And like you, had some experience in that area. And then I was noticing a combination of two things. Recently, in this 3-4 years, the sale prices that we were getting for some of the existing assets that we were selling into the market were off the chart, what I would consider crazy pricing, and prices that I would not pay to own those properties. And the market was telling us that that was the market for those properties. And we captured, I think, made the right decision and captured those values. Of course, when I look back, many of those properties are worth even more today. So, major in the real estate business, I'm sure you know, Chris. Yeah. However, that, and then combined with another factor, as we were bidding on acquisitions of existing properties, which had we done in many years, and we established some great relationships in the brokerage community, and as we reached the best and final offer stage amongst two or three other bidders, we were often told by the brokers what they thought it would take to win this deal. Mm-hmm. In many cases, they wanted to see us win the deal because they knew we had the ability to close and to execute, and we developed a reputation of being closers on time at the contract price without retrades. When I ran those numbers, I found that it was just crazy numbers that made no sense to us. I didn't see any cash flow or the upside. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we passed on those deals. They did sell to others. And as I started looking at what it would cost us to actually build and construct a newer product with better amenities for today's market in those mm-hmm. same markets mm-hmm. and take on the risk of leasing them up, of course, which is mm-hmm. the danger yep. and stabilization, we were all in at a better yield, at a better yield to cost cap rate yeah. than if we were to buy the same property that was maybe 10 or 15 years older.
Yeah. So a few things popped in my head during that process. One is you hit an important factor for people who were looking to get into multifamily or this type of development. You know, the lease up rate or absorption rate of your units, that really can make or break early on some of the financials of how quickly are you renting. And you want to make sure that you're probably conservative on that absorption rate. I've seen absorption rates off the charts that just don't match what the, you know, the market analysis says, and that can create a lot of havoc down the line. A few key points though, Michael, that you mentioned that I thought was really intriguing, and I have a question for you that you're going to laugh at when I ask this question. So you basically started by joint venturing with people who are more experienced.
And yes. one of the construction side. Yes. Yep.
And one of the things I see a lot of people doing right now, because, you know, right now, I'll use the term, anybody feels like they can make money in real estate or the last 5 years. I see people who have no real estate experience get into wanting to do a ground up multifamily project or off, right off the bat. And I'm curious what you would say to somebody if they came to you and said, I've never done a deal, but I want to go do a new construction ground up, 60 units over, 15 buildings or something.
I would say, stop, don't. find a partner that knows what they're doing, that you trust, and put in equity with them and look over their shoulder and learn it. Mm-hmm. And or do some acquisitions and value add that involve mm-hmm. some remodeling or some heavy construction. I've done mm-hmm. gut rehab type mm-hmm. things over the years, which is a little bit less of a lift, and learn the process before you leap in. Particularly today, the last couple of years, things were good. in terms of interest rates, in terms of predictability of construction costs. Today on our projects, we're dealing with escalating construction costs. We're dealing with interest rates that we didn't, you know, we figured increases in the deal, but we didn't figure this level. The good news is we also are dealing with rent increases that we didn't project, which offset those costs. But it's a bumpy ride, and it's not for those that don't want to take on some risk.
Question I had on interest rates on the multifamily side, because right now, you know, rates are, you know, depending on, you know, call it between 6% and 7%. But if cap rates are, you know, down at the 5%, you know, when you look at it previously, when cap rate, when interest rates were lower than cap rates, it basically kind of, you know, made sense. But now with interest rates above cap rates, now how do sponsors deal with that?
It's called negative leverage, which is the situation we're in today on most deals, acquisitions for sure. Not quite yet on development deals, because we're building to a return that's still higher than today's market borrowing costs, which is another reason to develop. But more equity and less debt costs you a little bit on return to investors, but I think it's worth limiting the risk so that the actual dollar payment out to the lender is similar to what it would have been under a higher loan amount, loan value. And getting it right on rent growth, where you go into a deal with negative leverage, where the cap rate, as you mentioned, is lower than the borrowing rate, you got to be sure you're in the market where you have enough confidence that you'll be able to grow rents so that in 2 or 3 years, you'll be at the point where the NOI that's produced at the property is actually producing a cap rate based on what you pay that's positive. That's going to be higher than the borrowing cost.
So for me, I read that as invest in locations that are either A or B type locations, your C class, D class rentals that typically don't appreciate or have very low rental growth. If you're in that type of situation now, it's probably not going to get better in those types of areas.
I'd be cautious of that. I'd also be cautious of very small markets that are not, that either aren't experiencing population growth or don't have a lot of renters in the pool. The bigger population areas, and I'm not talking about the major markets, even you know, a modest size MSA is going to have a rental pool to absorb the supply.
I want to quite kind of rolling into, you know, shifting gears a little bit, you know, going from acquiring to ground up and stuff, the financing side of things, you know, did you raise money from investors? How did you fund these deals? What did that structure look like?
Right. So the debt side of the multifamily business, we're all very fortunate. Those of us that are in multifamily is pretty good. It's held up through a number of cycles. It's actually proven out to be fairly recession proof. So local and regional banks on the debt side are still readily available. And we also have the agencies, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which are dedicated to making sure there's rental housing available. And they're a great place for the debt liquidity. On the equity side, we raise money from individual qualified investors, very high net worth investors, and family offices. And over the years, we've been fortunate to have developed a very strong investor base and a number of family offices that both trust us based on our track record and have the financial ability to place substantial dollars in deals. What I have learned and what I have the ability to do, fortunately, because I've been at it a long time, and built up equity, is investors love when the sponsor puts significant dollars of their own in the deal. I fortunately have the ability to do that. So it's a very strong selling point on raising money for a deal when I lead with the amount I'm putting in, which is usually a fair amount of the equity stack.
I mean, we raise money as well. And one of the first questions that I always get asked is, okay, how much skin you got in the game? And, you know, every syndication we've done, of course, I've always put skin in that game. And if you didn't, to me, that kind of sets off a little bit of red flags. Either one, you don't have the experience that you've gotten to a point where you are, where you can, you know, made enough money to put even some money in the deal, or, you know, it could be a high risk deal. Now, I also will say I wouldn't expect somebody to put all their money in the deal, because you want to be smart and diversify and not put all your eggs in one basket, of course. But, you know, you got to put some skin in game. Did you do it through like a Reg D 506C type offering, or is that?
We do a full private placement memorandum. We file with the SEC on our offerings, and we utilize that exemption. But we're very careful to furnish the PPM and an investor qualification questionnaire to all of our investors as well.
And for people that don't know, the Regulation D, you know, basically there's a 506C and a 506B. Those are exemptions from, you know, basically having to get qualified, you know, through the SEC. My company basically just completed a Regulation A plus offering, which did have to go through the SEC. But for Michael's point, they have a, you know, he's been at this for a very long time, so he's been able to build a nice stable of investors that are all high net worth, they're all accredited. And if, you know, you have the ability to go that route through the 506C, that, you know, that's definitely a beneficial way to go. Again, go back to that kind of that transition from the multifamily to the ground up side of things. You had some experience in the past. Are you basically acting as the developer and development manager where you're hiring the GC, or are you hiring a local or partnering with a local firm to basically manage, you know, or have some manage the local GC? How's that process working?
So good. We actually have the experience and the bandwidth on our staff, and we've developed it to act as the developer and overseer of the project. We use a reputable architect that we trust to be part of the construction management team and to sign off on all requests for payment. In the multifamily business, fortunately, we've been able to identify and use on multiple occasions GCs that specialize in the type of product we build for multifamily, have a good track record, and we're able to get a all-in price with a guaranteed max to produce the contract. I think we pay probably a little bit of a premium because they've got to add some protection in there for themselves.
Yep.
But we're more comfortable, and I sleep better at night with a guaranteed max price contract from a GC.
Yep. Yeah, that's something when I was on the GC side and on the developer side, you know, the GC prefers, you know, from risk perspective, it's like, okay, hey, I'll do the lump sum and so forth. Guarantee maximum price is more protections from the developer because, A, it's a guaranteed maximum price based off of the drawings, but really a scope. And I'm not going to get into all the details. But two things I think that are, you know, people should recognize and realize is, you know, as a developer, it's like you can have the greatest team in the world. But first, like you mentioned, that architect and your design team, you do not go cheap on them because you will have a lot of significant overruns, but schedule impacts as well. You know, the biggest thing on construction jobs a lot of times isn't some of the change orders of, okay, you missed this. It's a time for all the RFIs and everything. That's where the money gets burned because you're also leveraging that money. So it's burning a hole in the bank's in your pocket from the bank. And of course, you know, a lot of people like know the fact, hey, you don't go the cheapest on the general contractor. Yes, you want somebody experienced, but I think a lot of people sometimes forget about the architect. Would you agree?
Architect is used as well as the interior designer, as well as the civil engineer when you're doing ground up construction for site work and to make sure they got the underground right and the site plan right and the drainage. We don't go cheap on our professionals, and you've got to do that. Another, Chris, you know, of late, another thing that just came to my mind when you mentioned the timing that can trip you up with professionals that didn't do their right job, supply chain issues now on materials. Forget about the cost, which we're fortunate enough to be able to lock it in and, you know, not be at risk on that. But there are certain materials where the lag times are unbelievable, a year. So you need a good experienced construction team and GC that knows how to order those things in advance, perhaps arrange to store them and warehouse them if they come in before they actually are needed in the project. And it's a new part of the timeline of planning project.
Oh, it's interesting. I had a call 3-4 weeks ago. Someone reached out to me and they want to do like ground up job, and they hadn't done one before, and kind of this topic came up, and I just started rattling off, and I could tell the person's, I think I scared them enough not to do it, because, you know, I mentioned, I'm like, well, yeah, you got to stay on the GC because you want to make sure he buys out the trades early on, because you got to get the submittals in and make sure the architect's geared up to review those submittals up front, because you need to get those approved ASAP, because you need to get all this shit ordered, excuse my French. Yeah. And just going through that process, and you said submittals, what are those? And I'm like, something else, you know, right?
Yeah, you're not, don't do this, right? That's going back to find someone like you or somebody else that you can put some money with or do it JV on. And that's how you should do your first ground up.
So how have you found the land? Is it been through your broker relationships? Is it been through kind of, you know, just reach out, or, you know, how have you been able to define the land, and how have you structured, you know, because I know that's kind of important too, of kind of structuring, you know, land, because you don't want, you know, a lot of times you want to get it under agreement, but you also want to see what it can get permitted for before you pull the final trigger. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
We've found success in utilizing the land brokerage community, identifying the top land brokers in each of the markets that we want to be active in, and having them present deals and concepts. Some of them sometimes in the land business are off market, but the brokers know about them, and some are actually listed. And we have found that the best way to find opportunities. And then when we find an opportunity in a seller, as you mentioned, when it comes contract time, it's a very different process than buying an existing asset when you have a rent roll in place. You know, you've got an operating business, basically. You set a closing date, do your due diligence, get your loan, you close. There's unknowns in the land development business, as you know, the most major of which is the entitlement process. And that varies by community. Very, very rare to find a good piece of land in a good community that's either undeveloped or developed with another use that would make a good multifamily project that is zoned for multifamily. Mm-hmm. So you have to go into the local municipality, which we do first informally after we tie up the property, and we tie it up for a period of time in due diligence that is longer than typical than a regular purchase of property. Explain, and usually sellers of land understand it's a process. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon to, we put up earnest money and we have a period of time, usually that's 4 or 5 months for initial entitlements. We get a feel from the municipality we're dealing with on it, get familiar with the process, go through the public hearing process and know where we stand. We try and negotiate extensions because sometimes that's not enough, 4 to 5 months. And we generally are able to negotiate them in the contract. Sometimes agree to go hard on a portion of our earnest money in order to get those extensions, because we may not be final on entitlements, but we have a pretty good idea at that point where it is in the process and that it's going to happen or not. Our personal policy in our company is that we won't close on the land until it's fully entitled. There are developers that will roll the bones as we speak. And over the years, I've seen lots of deals with somebody stuck with a piece of land that they can't develop because they didn't get the zoning, basically unsellable.
So I jump in right there. So I, after 10 years of working for a GC, I got burnt out and had an opportunity to go work for a multifamily developer who did exactly, basically garden style, suburban multifamily. And they were based out of Texas, did a lot of work in the East Coast, and I was up in New England. And they, and this is literally 2008. I started with them in 2000, beginning of like 2008.
That was there, a bad year.
Yeah, I wasn't there. I wasn't there long, because one of the things they did was they bought the land before they had an entitled. Yeah. And they basically, when the economy tanked, you know, they had debt on all this that basically went under. And later on, I worked for another developer and they basically did exactly what you did. They would not buy the land. They would have it agreed upon and they would strike deals too, because they did more like townhouse style for sale product, you know, and they basically based the price off of how many units they could get. So it was basically, hey, if we can do 100 units versus 110, hey, whatever we get entitled, more for the seller. So a few things though that kind of, again, popped in my head when you're mentioning this, so people also understand this, when you're going through that entitlement phase, you have engineers and, you know, your civil and stuff looking at things, all that cost, you know, that's pretty much out of your pocket, correct?
Yeah, that's totally at risk. We call it chase costs. Yep. And the fancy name for it is pre-development costs. We phase it so that at each step, we have a good feeling that it's happening. But in order to get the entitlement, you need full engineering plans. You need a site plan, a lot of architectural plan that gets coordinated with the civil engineer. And all the while, we're talking to the GC about rough, you know, non-binding ballparks of, you know, where we think this thing will come in at. And we also add in our soft costs at that time, but it's pretty substantial. We don't pull the trigger on those until we've had a good meeting with the local municipality that we see a path to entitlements. But we've had some where we've had to pull the plug and it hurts. It's at-risk money over and above earnest money that we get back.
And, you know, if you ever hear the phrase, the NIMBY or not in my backyard, when, you know, that is one of the big risks going from, you know, hey, you're buying an existing apartment building or existing property. You know, that's entitled. That is what it is. But is ground up construction, you know, depending on the type of area that you're going to be building in, anywhere from, I built a property next to a dog park. And I'll tell you, those people from the dog park, they were ferocious, no pun intended, from blocking sun, blocking views, you know, the height of the building, anything that can be brought up is typically brought up during those components. Would you agree?
100% agree. And we make a conscious effort before the formal notice and formal hearings, we actually reach out informally to all the surrounding property owners that by law are going to get notice of it or see a sign go up that there's a zoning hearing. Mm-hmm. And we arrange a meeting at a local library or community center for them. We come with all of our professionals, our site plans. We pay for pretty expensive, fancy color looking renderings. And we do a presentation, take their feedback, try and accommodate them. On almost every project we've ever done, I just thinking of the most recent one, as a result of those meetings, we've committed to neighbors and promised to do certain modifications like extra trees and fencing between our property and theirs, changing the entrance or the exit so that the headlights don't shine in their windows, comments that they come up with. But they still frequently in a lot of communities show up at hearings. Some people are very vocal in an ignorant way about what they think a profile of a renter is and why they don't want them as neighbors. We do a good job in advance of educating the village in advance, and as well as bring data that shows the quality of today's renter and the type of product we build, which is pretty high end and luxury, so that and we show what the income levels are required to lease that type of property, as well as our screening process for criminal and credit checks before someone can sign a lease. And we kind of alleviate the fear factor that the NIMBYs show up with.
Yeah. And, you know, I was on your website, mzcapitalpartners.com, and looking at some of the product you build. And yes, it's definitely high end, a lot of amenity driven as well. Over the last, you know, few years, from a competitive standpoint, have you found, you know, what has been kind of the factor? Because I know there was a shift, you know, from a lot of, you know, certain, you know, whether it's a 3-bedroom, 2-bedroom down to studios and ones, depending on the jurisdiction. But up in our region, which is, again, the Washington, D.C. capital, we'll call it the capital region or the DMV for D.C., Maryland, Virginia, you know, the focus has really been prized on the amenities. And that's really what was getting people in the door and into your units. Where you've built your communities, what has been the, I'll call it your factor, your making, you know, what's made you, giving you that competitive advantage?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Amenities are driving rentals for prospects, both in terms of the presentation at those neighborhood meetings and at planning commissions, but also once the project is built, to convert prospects into tenants. And the amenities people are looking for today are modern 9-foot ceilings in apartments rather than the lower standard 8-foot, kitchens with granite or quartz countertops, really nice cabinetry and stainless steel appliances. And then in terms of the common areas, green space in the suburban type of venue, not urban, is very important. Places to walk a dog and dog park and being a dog-friendly building, very important today. Mm-hmm. And then in the clubhouse, we like to design a clubhouse in our communities, a state-of-the-art fitness center, club-like fitness center. We even go to the extent now of we put in Peloton and Mirror machines where we pay for the monthly subscription. So it's free to the resident. And a resident looks at that as an alternative to having to pay to join a local health club. They use it as their fitness center. And a very recent, as a result of the pandemic, work from home private suite areas in the clubhouse. If someone wants to get out of their apartment, on whether they're a hybrid worker or totally remote worker, as well as co-working areas where they can meet with colleagues during the day and meet. And that, of course, also implies the real amenity that most people care about is the highest possible super speed internet you could find. So we do that, and it's evolved over time.
Few things that we've seen in our region, our area, everything you said, the business centers, the business suites in our location, one of the things people were okay with the smaller, you know, smaller unit sizes, but they wanted a place more of a gathering place. Now, when I rented many years ago, a lot of people in our communities kind of didn't have the clubs, or people didn't go to the club rooms to gather and stuff. And now kind of they're made a focal point. Like one building we built had a demo kitchen area. And once or twice a month, they're bringing a chef to teach people how to cook and have kind of wine. And you get 30, 40 people there kind of just networking and learning. And it was a way to really bring the community together and give that sense of community that I think people today really strive for.
I couldn't agree more. People look for it and strive for it. And we've done kitchens as well. We usually do in the clubhouse, a demonstrator kitchen. One of the great amenities that brings the community together, aside from the standard really nice billiards table, we have a Scrabble game mega board that gets mounted on a wall with big magnetic Scrabble pieces and then a pit around it with chairs. And it's really popular for gathering where residents come and play together, where sometimes they even meet each other for the first time when they move in. Not only is that a great amenity to build community, but it's a great amenity to build renewals because it creates a stickiness to the property and to the friends and the rest of the people in the community that residents enjoy. And with leases expiring at different times all at once, people, if they decide to move somewhere else, they're not just leaving their apartment, they're leaving their community and they're leaving their friends behind, and they're reluctant to do that.
So that and Amazon lockers.
You can't build enough. It's crazy. That makes us nuts. I mean, any storeroom for package delivery is too small by the time it gets built.
I'm laughing because we had that issue where, you know, we finished a building in like 2017 and it started, the design was like 2013. So it was tied up. It was a 284 unit, 15 story building. So by the time we finished, we had the storage room and we're walking there. And also I'm sitting there going, oh my God, this is, I'm like, okay, where are we gonna? So, you know, this had below grade parking, which, you know, there's also never enough below grade parking, but we ended up, you know, trying to transfer. And I mean, it's, the package thing is always something
never ending. We got lucky on a recent project we developed. After we started developing, Amazon decided to open up one of their Amazon Fresh stores across the street from us, mm-hmm. which includes a free delivery of packages with lockers, as well as drop off for returns. So a number of residents would use that Amazon facility, not have them shipped to the building, which helped relieve the flow a little bit.
You've been very successful in your business. What are some of the things, you know, if you look back on your career, what are a few things that you look back on and say, and again, there's probably 1,000 things because it's not usually just one or two things, but if you had to pick like 2 or 3 things, what are some of the things you thought, you know, either decisions you made or just your style that were things that you've done that might not be consistent with a lot of people, or just it is consistent with success that you could leave people with?
The one thing, and the word that's overused today, but the one thing that I've done throughout my career and our company's lifetime is pivot and watch trends and see what's really happening. There was a time when we were doing all condominium conversions, buying buildings and gutting them, and selling the condos, and then to the, you know, rentals and older buildings. And as I mentioned, renovations and buying existing properties. And then the most recent pivot to development, just watching the trends and the yields. Mm-hmm. My guess is it probably won't last forever because we've always evolved into different niches mm-hmm. and different properties. And the same thing with markets and neighborhoods and mm-hmm. within a city submarkets that look like they're taking off for rent growth is to really be flexible and don't always think you're just going to do exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I guess the other thing in real estate, a lot of people have different philosophies, but one of mine is on a particular asset and on a particular property. What it's worth today, when you wake up in the morning, if you hold it, you're making a decision to buy that property at that price. Whether internally you know it or not, you really are. You know, obviously, you've got to take into consideration taxes and capital gains and loan covenants and penalties. But, you know, once you filter through that, if you hold something, you've made a decision to buy it at today's price. That should weigh in your decision whether to dispose of an asset or hold it frequently. And then, you know, the last thing is just, a lot of people look at real estate investors or real estate developers as tough, cutthroat guys. It's never been my approach, it's just not my personality. But I actually think from a selfish business standpoint, it works to be a good guy and, you know, not to go for the jugular and not to go for the last buck or retrade a deal or guy comes in with a fair price on a contract for a remodeling. Give him the job. Don't tell him you want it for less. And pay people quickly. When we get billed, we pay within a couple weeks. We don't wait. And I hear over the years from contractors and GCs and even banks that makes you stand out. And when you need them, they're going to respond to you. And they deserve the money if they perform the service.
Yeah, that is, again, through my career, that's one of the first questions every subcontractor asks a GC is how quickly do you pay? And GC asks the developer and vice versa. The developer asks the GC, how quickly do you pay your subs? Because, you know, typically the way, you know, and I don't think people understand this. An example that we used to use when we were, you know, early on is it's like going to a drive-thru at McDonald's, getting your hamburger, driving away, eating it, and going back a month later and paying for it. Because that's essentially, right now we're in mid-October, a contractor would start putting their bill together, usually around today or 25th for their work in October. So they would bill through what's done in October. It takes several weeks to get through. The bank has to also, if there's lending, approve it and stuff. If they're lucky, they'll get paid by the end of November. You know, now it sounds like you can really streamline that to get it within a few weeks. But, you know, a lot of developers want to hold that money as long as possible. So sometimes it might be 30, 45 days. So think about that, you know, as, you know, in certain sense where a lot of people who are on the residential side, literally your contractor wants to get paid that day or within a week. On commercial side, it's normal for the October work to get funded mid to end of November.
So yes.
One thing that I think that I picked up from this, you know, this podcast, I think a differentiator or a piece of your success has been the team you build around you. And you mentioned about you look for the architect, the GC, you don't nickel and dime the people you work with. I get the impression that you put a well-established team and you're not going for the lowest price on any single asset or aspect of the project. You want to put qualified people and understand what somebody's worth is. And I think that is something for people to also understand.
Yes, absolutely fundamental to success and to the type of business you want to be known as and the type of life that you want to lead.
Yeah, because like you mentioned about your business and your brand, you know, you don't want to be known as the developer who just hires, you know, some random, you know, call it the pickup truck contractor that does the work and then it's shoddy work. Then your tenants are always putting in. And again, you pay for it one way or the other.
Yeah, another example is on the, we talked about the acquisition of land and the brokerage community side. You want to be the guy with the go-to broker in the town that you're working on to know that you're the guy that moves quickly, that puts up real money and that closes on time and makes sure that the seller's paid and that they earn their commission and makes it an easy transaction that you don't, and you don't go nuts on contract terms and make people crazy over stuff you don't need in the contract, that you're easy to deal with because that's going to lead to more deals coming your way.
Especially if you've done, like, again, on your website, some of these projects are, you know, they're beautiful. If you've built one of those and you want to go into another community, and then again, like you mentioned, they're concerned about what a renter, you know, the persona of a renter, which is misrepresented, is, you show them, hey, this is what we build. Right. You know, it looks like a luxury condo.
Exactly.
You've done a lot of giving back and doing good while doing well. Can you share some stories for people of what you've done?
I'd like to remain very active civically in our community and with charitable organizations, both in leadership positions as well as writing checks to annual campaigns. But one of the things that we've done that we started doing a few years ago, directly related to the real estate we own and the communities that we're in, is each year around this time of year, right around Thanksgiving, we approach the local food pantry, anywhere where we have a community that we own or under development. And we discuss with them the cost of feeding a family of four in their community. And we might make a donation from that property to the food pantry in that local community in a dollar amount to cover the cost of feeding a family of four in their community for 1 year. It's been very rewarding. We think it's the right thing to do. And it's also led to tremendous reputation amongst our renters. We put the word out as well as in the local communities themselves as being a good corporate citizen.
It's pretty impressive, you know, family of four for 1 year. So I'm sure, that's something that I'm sure greatly appreciated throughout the community. And again, it's not something that somebody has to do, but it's part of giving back and taking, you know, being able to have the ability to do that. So, one of the things, like, you know,
fortunate to have the ability, and we feel it's our obligation to do so because we have the ability.
As we wrap up on this episode, I do have one question. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit because I'm curious to get your opinion. No, it's not a bad question. I'm just curious to see if, your mindset's in a similar place as mine in regards to, you know, there's many different aspects of real estate investing. You know, there's residential, multifamily, there's the ground up that we talked about. You know, our primary focus is on distressed debt. You know, we invest in notes. I'm curious to, you know, your opinion on short-term rentals and where that market's headed, if you want to give an opinion.
I've kind of been watching it and I like it a lot. I've actually toyed with holding aside on some of our new developments. We haven't decided yet on holding some of the units rather than doing full leases on them for a year within the community of furnishing them and doing both short-term corporate rentals, as well as possibly even Airbnbs for real short-term usage, both corporate and leisure. The total gross income on a monthly basis is substantially higher than on a lease. I see a growing market for it. I think there's something there. I think the pandemic helped as well. A lot of people got away from, I'm surprised at how many friends I have that are not staying in hotels anymore. They just, they do an Airbnb, and it's like, really, you do that? And you know, they kind of explain it to me, and it's it's growing in popularity.
Yeah. I was working for a developer who has about 1500 units, and they were toying with that idea of taking units offline to use them for, you know, the short-term rental housing. Unfortunately, got a lot of pushback, you know, from local jurisdictions in regards to what you can and can't do. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges with the short-term where, you know, for me, I personally believe, hey, look, if you're developing 160 garden style units and you want to leave, you know, 3 or 5% of them for short-term housing, absolutely. I don't know why they wouldn't let you. Now, if you're in a cul-de-sac community and someone wants to take it and turn it into a short, you know, several houses in that community, it's a completely different animal and you can't judge it by that way. And that's kind of where things kind of get, I think, mixed up with some of these officials.
Yeah. And I think also if it's done in a professionally managed community, there's a filter on qualification and it's not, a party house for the local senior prom, which is gets the headlines and the bad rap.
Well, Michael, it's going to wrap up this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. If people want to learn more about your company, reach out to you, what's the best way for them to find out more information about you?
The best way is really through our website, mzcapitalpartners.com. And there's a contact us button. If you just say, please direct it to me, I'll get it. And they can learn much more about us online.
And like always, we'll leave all this information in the show notes. We would like to thank you for listening or watching this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. As always, make sure to subscribe to get notified of new episodes and also subscribe to our YouTube channel where we provide content on all aspects of real estate, creating wealth, as well as mortgage note investing. So thank you all.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.